All right, so we're diving into this case, and you know, on the surface, it might seem like a total blast from the past, but bear with me.
Yeah.
Because Reitman v. Mahlke, a Supreme Court case from, wait for it, 1967.
Wow.
Still has some serious implications for legal battles happening right now.
I think that's right.
Think voter ID laws or even some cases that are going on now that revolve around LGBTQ plus rights.
Mm.
So today we're going deep on Reitman v. Mahlke and why it matters.
All right. Sounds good.
This case, like I said, went all the way up to the Supreme Court.
It did.
Back in 67. And it still has lawyers arguing about the limits of something called state action today. So to help break all this down, we have, as always, our legal expert.
Hello.
So glad to have you here.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Let's jump right in. What's so fascinating about Reitman v. Mahlke? Why should our listeners care about this case?
Well, I think what's really fascinating about Reitman is that it forces us, as legal minds, to think about discrimination in kind of a whole new light. You see, the 14th Amendment was designed to prevent the government from denying anyone equal protection of the law.
Right. Classic 14th Amendment stuff.
Right. But what happens when the state isn't directly discriminating, but they're kind of creating these conditions where discrimination can flourish, like kind of setting the stage but not actually doing it themselves? That's really the question that landed Reitman v. Mahlke right on the Supreme Court's doorstep.
Okay, so paint the picture for us. Mm-hmm. What was happening in the U.S., and maybe more specifically in California, that led to this landmark case?
Sure. Picture California in the 1960s, right? The civil rights movement is in full swing.
Huge moment in history.
Right. And a major battleground is this fight for fair housing. So California had actually passed the Rumford Fair Housing Act, which was a pretty progressive law for the time. It was designed to, like, prevent discrimination in housing. But then things took a bit of a sharp turn.
Hold on. Did you say California passed a fair housing law and then something else happened? So they were trying to make it fair and then...
You're catching on quick.
Okay.
So California voters, and this is the tension of the era, they passed something called Proposition 14. And this amendment to the state constitution basically said that property owners could refuse to sell or rent to anyone for any reason. So it essentially wiped out all those protections of the Rumford Act.
Wow.
And it basically gave like a legal thumbs up to racial discrimination in housing.
Okay, so going from trying to outlaw discrimination to basically saying, go for it.
Yeah, really a step backward.
So that's wild. So enter the Mahlkes, an African-American couple who are searching for housing and kind of run headfirst into this legal mess. What happened?
Right. So the Mahlkes, they were denied housing simply because of their race. And under Proposition 14, that was totally legal. But they decided to fight back. And their case, I think, became a real lightning rod, eventually making its way all the way to, like we said, the Supreme Court.
Okay. This is where things get really interesting, legally speaking, right?
Yeah.
Because now we're not just talking about one couple who was discriminated against. We're talking about, like, the very definition of state action.
Right.
And how far the 14th Amendment can reach.
Exactly.
So break this down for us.
So the Supreme Court's decision in Reitman sent kind of, I think, shockwaves through the legal system.
Really?
Yeah, because the court ultimately sided with the Mahlkes and they struck down Proposition 14.
Wow. So the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
But wouldn't some people say that Proposition 14 just gave property owners, like, more freedom of choice?
Sure.
Like, how did the court justify, like, intervening in what some might consider, like, a purely private matter?
That's where that state action doctrine really comes in.
Okay.
The court, and this was in the majority opinion written by Justice White, they argued that, you know, by enshrining this right to discriminate in its state constitution, California was no longer just being neutral. They were creating a situation where discrimination could, like, thrive. It'd be like, you know, if the state was handing over the puppet strings of discrimination to private individuals.
Okay.
And then claiming that their hands were clean.
Interesting. So the court recognized that even though the proposition didn't say you must discriminate, it was basically like setting the stage for it.
That's right.
But how do you legally prove that a state's intent was to enable discrimination? Like, that seems kind of subjective, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's a good point. You've hit on a key point of legal debate here. And the court looked at three very specific factors in Reitman to determine the state's intent. So first, they looked at the immediate objective of Proposition 14, which was clearly to allow discrimination in housing. Second, they considered the effect, the undeniable effect of the proposition, which was increased segregation.
Makes sense.
And finally, they considered the historical context.
Okay.
Especially the fact that Proposition 14 came right after the Rumford Fair Housing Act. And so it was pretty clear that the intent was to kind of circumvent those protections.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, they just passed this law and then very quickly passed a law that seemed to go against it.
Right.
So it does seem like there's a pattern there. So basically, the court looked at the big picture, not just the words in the law, but trying to figure out the state's true intentions. But I'm guessing not everyone agreed with the court's decision here, right? Weren't there some pretty strong dissenting opinions in this case?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think understanding those dissenting opinions is crucial to really grasping, like, how complex this case is.
Right.
Justice Harlan, for example, he argued that Proposition 14 was, like, neutral on its face. He said that it just expanded property owners' freedom of choice and that the court was, you know, overstepping its bounds by defining it as state action.
So Harlan basically felt that, like, the state wasn't doing anything to actually promote discrimination. They were just giving people more freedom. And he felt like that should include the freedom to discriminate.
Right. He took a very literal interpretation.
That's pretty compelling, though, isn't it? I mean, if the state just backs off and lets people make their own choices, even if those choices might be discriminatory, isn't that, in a way, upholding individual liberty?
Yeah.
It makes you wonder if the court was truly being objective in its interpretation, or if they were swayed by the social and political climate of the civil rights movement, you know? Like, was this truly a legal decision or a moral one?
You're getting to the heart of the matter.
So where do you stand?
Yeah, it's a tough one.
Was the court overreaching, or were they righting a historical wrong?
It's a debate that we're going to have to keep unpacking. Yeah, it's a debate legal scholars still kind of wrestle with today.
Hmm.
Like, was the Rightman decision really a necessary step toward achieving equality, or did it overstep the boundaries of judicial power? It's a question that goes, I think, to the heart of how we interpret the Constitution and the role of the courts in shaping social policy.
That's a good point. It's interesting you bring up, like, the social and political climate of the time. Do you think if this case had been heard, like, a decade earlier, before the civil rights movement gained so much momentum, do you think the court would reach the same conclusion?
That's a great question. You know, it's impossible to know for sure, but
right.
What we can say is that legal precedents, they don't exist in a vacuum.
Right.
They're shaped by societal values and cultural shifts and political pressures. All of those things are at play.
So in a way, like, Rightman v. Mulkey is kind of like a snapshot of a particular moment in American history, a moment when the legal system was being forced to confront, like, deeply ingrained prejudices and redefine those boundaries between, like, individual rights versus the common good. But let's not forget, at the heart of this landmark case is a real human story.
Right.
The story of the Mulkeys themselves.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. It's easy to get kind of lost in those legal abstractions, but it's important to remember that the Mulkeys were real people, a family, who were denied housing just because of the color of their skin.
Yeah, and imagine the courage that it took for them to challenge the status quo.
Totally.
Take their case all the way to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
I mean, their story is a reminder, a huge reminder, of the human cost of discrimination and, like, reminds us that legal battles are often fought by ordinary people who are just seeking justice and equality.
I couldn't agree more. And their story also reminds us that these landmark legal decisions, they don't happen overnight.
Right.
You know, they're often the result of years of struggle and advocacy and just countless individual acts of courage.
Yeah.
The Mulkeys were pioneers in this fight for fair housing.
Mm.
And their case really paved the way for, I think, greater equality and opportunity for millions of Americans.
And their legacy continues to inspire today, right? Mm. I mean, the fight for equality is ongoing.
Oh, yeah.
And the principles that were at stake in Rightman v. Mulkey are still being debated in courts all over the country.
Yeah, absolutely. Rightman established a powerful precedent that has been cited in so many cases, countless cases involving discrimination in areas like employment, education, even access to public accommodations. It's a reminder that seemingly neutral laws, actions by the state, can have a discriminatory impact.
Right.
And that the courts, they have a role to play here. They have to step in and ensure that the promise of equal protection under the law is a reality for all citizens.
So Rightman essentially gave us this new lens through which to view state action.
Yeah.
And its potential to perpetuate discrimination, even indirectly. But how has this concept of state action kind of evolved since 1967? Has the legal interpretation remained consistent, or has it been, you know, refined and maybe even challenged in subsequent cases?
That's a crucial question because, like you said, the legal landscape is constantly kind of shifting. Since Reitman, the courts have continued to grapple with, like, all the nuances of this state action doctrine. And there have been cases where the doctrine has been applied really broadly and others where it's been interpreted more narrowly.
Could you give us an example of a case where the application of the state action doctrine was maybe particularly controversial or a bit unexpected?
Yeah, one example that comes to mind is the case of Shelley v. Kramer.
Okay.
This was actually decided by the Supreme Court back in 1948.
Oh, wow. So almost 20 years before Reitman.
Yeah, almost 20 years before Reitman. In Shelley, the court ruled that these racially restrictive covenants, and these were agreements among homeowners not to sell their property to people of certain races, were unenforceable in state courts.
So even though these covenants were, like, private agreements between individuals, the court found that state enforcement of those agreements constituted state action.
Right.
And therefore violated the 14th Amendment.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
It seems like the court was already kind of laying the groundwork for that state action doctrine, as it would later be applied in Reitman. But wasn't Shelley really focused on preventing the judicial system from being used to enforce discrimination? Whereas Reitman dealt with a state law that, like, seemingly endorsed discrimination.
Right.
How did the court, like, reconcile these two approaches to state action?
Yeah, you've hit upon, I think, a key distinction there. And the court has had to navigate those nuances very carefully. In both Shelley and Reitman, the court recognized that the state can't be a passive bystander when it comes to discrimination. Even if the state isn't directly engaging in discriminatory acts, it can't allow its power and authority to be used to, like, facilitate or enforce discrimination by private individuals.
So the court's interpretation of state action really hinges on this idea that the state has an affirmative obligation to prevent discrimination, even when it's rooted in, like, seemingly private actions or agreements. That's a pretty powerful concept, isn't it?
It is indeed. And it's had far-reaching implications for, like, civil rights law in the U.S. But it's also important to note that the application of the state action doctrine is not always straightforward.
Right. I can imagine there are a lot of gray areas, legal loopholes that could make it really tricky to determine when the state is truly entangled in those private acts of discrimination. Are there any specific examples that come to mind?
Certainly. I mean, the court has had to wrestle with this whole range of cases involving issues like private businesses refusing service to LGBTQ plus customers, or even state funding being used to support organizations that engage in discriminatory practices. And these cases often involve really complex questions about, like, what level of state involvement is required to trigger that state action doctrine, and whether, you know, seemingly neutral policies can have a disproportionate impact on protected groups.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It seems like the state action doctrine is less about, like, this rigid set of rules and more about a framework for analyzing the relationship between state power and private discrimination.
Absolutely.
A framework that has to be constantly reevaluated and adapted to this changing social and legal landscape.
I think that's right.
Would you say that's a fair assessment?
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that makes, I think, Reitman v. Mulkey such a fascinating and enduring case. You know, it's not just about those specific facts of that case. It's about these broader principles of equality, state responsibility, and that ongoing struggle to ensure that the law protects the rights of all citizens.
Speaking of the broader implications of Reitman, let's shift gears a bit and talk about how this case continues to be relevant in, like, the 21st century.
Okay, sure.
What are some current legal battles or social issues that echo the themes that we're seeing in Reitman v. Mulkey?
Well, one area where the state action doctrine is being, like, actively debated today is in the context of voter ID laws.
That's a great example. So these laws, which require voters to present, you know, identification at the polls, are often framed as a way to prevent voter fraud.
Right.
But critics argue that they disproportionately disenfranchise minority voters.
Yeah.
Who are less likely to have those government-issued IDs.
Exactly. And the question becomes, is a state's implementation of a voter ID law a neutral act aimed at, like, ensuring election integrity? Or is it a form of state action that's kind of indirectly facilitating discrimination against certain groups of voters?
So it all boils down to intent, right?
Yeah.
Is the state intentionally trying to disenfranchise certain voters, or are they pursuing a legitimate goal?
Yeah.
Even if that goal has, like, unintended consequences that disproportionately impact certain communities.
Right. And it's a thorny question. Mm. And the courts are still grappling with, like, how to apply the state action doctrine in these cases. You know, some courts have struck down voter ID laws, finding that they violate the 14th Amendment's guarantee of equal protection, mm-hmm. while others have actually upheld them.
So it's a reminder that the legacy of Reitman v. Mulkey isn't just a matter of, you know, historical interest.
Right.
It's a living legal principle.
Absolutely.
That continues to shape the way we think about state power, discrimination, and the fight for equality.
Exactly. Reitman v. Mulkey really gives us this framework
for understanding how seemingly neutral policies can have these discriminatory impacts. And it highlights the court's role in making sure that the law is used to protect rather than undermine the rights of all citizens.
So what are some of the key takeaways that you hope your listeners are gleaning from this deep dive into Reitman v. Mulkey? What lessons can we learn from this case that might help us better understand and even navigate these, like, complex legal and social challenges we face today?
Well, I think one of the most important takeaways from Reitman is that discrimination is rarely overt or explicit anymore. It often operates in more subtle and kind of insidious ways, hiding behind this seemingly neutral language and procedures.
Mm.
This case really teaches us to be vigilant,
yeah,
to look beyond the surface and examine the intent and impact of these laws and policies.
Yeah, it's about recognizing that discrimination can be baked into the system.
Right.
Even if it's not always staring us right in the face.
Exactly.
So we need to be critical thinkers, ask those tough questions, and challenge those assumptions. Absolutely. And I think we need to remember that these legal precedents like Reitman v. Mulkey aren't just like abstract concepts. They have real world consequences.
Yeah.
They can be powerful tools for social change, but they can also be misused or misinterpreted to perpetuate injustice. So it's really our responsibility, you know, as informed citizens to understand these legal principles and engage in this ongoing dialogue about how to apply them fairly and effectively in like a constantly evolving society.
I love that perspective. It's not enough to just know the law.
Mm-hmm.
We have to understand how it operates in practice,
yeah,
and use that knowledge to advocate for a more just and equitable world. But before we wrap up our discussion of Reitman v. Mulkey, I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier about the court's decision being influenced by like the social and political climate of the 1960s. Do you think that's always the case? I mean, are legal decisions inevitably shaped by like the prevailing social norms and political pressures of the time? Or is there such a thing as objective legal reasoning?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the age-old debate about, you know, judicial activism versus judicial restraint.
Right.
Do judges simply interpret the law, or do they also shape it?
Precisely. And it's a debate that's raged for centuries, really.
Yeah.
There's no easy answer. And, you know, reasonable minds can disagree.
Yeah.
But I think it's safe to say that judges are human beings. And as such, they're inevitably influenced by their own experiences and beliefs and the broader context in which they operate.
So even if they're striving for impartiality, their decisions are always going to be shaped to some degree,
yeah,
by their own subjective perspective.
Right.
And the prevailing kind of social winds. That's a pretty sobering thought, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
It makes you wonder if true objectivity in legal interpretation is even possible.
It's a question that legal philosophers and scholars have debated for centuries.
Yeah.
And again, there's no easy answer. But I think it highlights the importance of having a diverse judiciary, you know, a court that reflects a wide range of perspectives and experiences. Because the more diverse the court, the more likely it is that different viewpoints will be considered, and that legal decisions will be informed by this broader understanding of the social and human impact of the law.
So diversity on the bench isn't just about representation. It's about ensuring that the law is interpreted and applied in a way that reflects, like, the complexities of our society and protects the rights of all citizens.
Absolutely. And it's a reminder that the pursuit of justice is an ongoing process.
Yeah.
A dialogue that requires constant vigilance, critical thinking, and a willingness to challenge our own assumptions.
Well said. Now, before we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave our listeners with a thought-provoking question that's been kind of swirling in my mind throughout our discussion. We've talked a lot about the legal and historical significance of Reitman v. Mulkey. But I'm curious about your personal take on this case. If you were a justice on the Supreme Court back in 1967, how would you have voted on Reitman v. Mulkey?
Oh, that's a tough one. You're really putting me on the spot here.
Come on, don't be shy. I'm sure our listeners are dying to know which side of the legal fence you'd fall on.
Well, if you're really twisting my arm, I have to say, oak.
Yeah.
Well, I have to admit, this case presents a real dilemma, you know. On the one hand, I see the merit in Justice Harlan's argument about, like, protecting those property rights and individual freedom of choice.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, I can't ignore that undeniable reality that Proposition 14 was, at its core, a tool designed to perpetuate racial discrimination in housing.
So you're feeling the weight of that judicial responsibility,
mm-hmm.
having to balance those individual rights with the broader kind of societal need for equality. It's not an easy decision, that's for sure.
It's not, no. And that's why cases like Reitman are so fascinating. They force us to confront these, like, really fundamental tensions in our legal system. Ultimately, I think I would have sided with the majority in striking down Proposition 14.
Really? Interesting. So what tipped the scales for you? Was it the historical context, like that blatant attempt to circumvent the Rumford Fair Housing Act?
The historical context was definitely a factor. But for me, the most compelling argument is the potential for harm. Allowing the state to essentially sanction discrimination, even indirectly, it creates this dangerous precedent. It sends this message that, you know, certain groups of people are not fully entitled to the same rights and protections as others.
Yeah, it's like saying, sure, you have equal rights on paper, but we're going to create a system where those rights can be easily undermined.
That's right.
And that's a recipe for, like, systemic inequality.
Exactly. And I think the court has this responsibility to safeguard against that kind of systemic injustice.
Okay.
Even if it means stepping on some toes along the way.
That makes sense. It's about recognizing that the law is not just this neutral set of rules, but it's a really powerful instrument that can be used to either promote or hinder equality. And in the case of Reitman v. Mulkey, the court chose to wield that instrument in favor of equality.
I agree. And I think that decision had this really profound impact on the trajectory of civil rights law in this country. You know, it set a precedent that continues to resonate today, I think, reminding us that the state has an obligation to, like, proactively protect the rights of all its citizens, not just stand idly by while discrimination kind of festers in the shadows.
So Reitman wasn't just a victory for the Mulkeys. It was a victory for, like, that very idea of equal protection under the law.
Yeah.
It expanded our understanding of what state action means.
Right.
And forced us to confront the ways in which discrimination can be, like, woven into the fabric of our society, even when it's not, you know, explicitly stated.
Absolutely. And it reminds us that the fight for equality is a marathon, not a sprint. There will always be new challenges, new ways in which discrimination tries to rear its ugly head.
Mm-hmm.
But cases like Reitman v. Mulkey, they give us the legal tools and the moral compass to continue that fight, to ensure that that promise of equality actually becomes a reality for all.
Well, I think that's a perfect note to end on. We've covered a lot of ground today, explored the historical context of Reitman v. Mulkey, delved into those complexities of the state action doctrine, and even wrestled with some, like, tough philosophical questions about, you know, the nature of law and justice.
It's been a fascinating discussion, and I hope our listeners have gained, like, a deeper appreciation for this landmark case and its enduring relevance, I think, in today's world.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into Reitman v. Mulkey. We'll see you next time for another fascinating exploration of the legal landscape.
See you then.
Keep those legal minds sharp, and as always, stay curious.